faces. Otherwise, he'd be sitting right behind her in chemistry and American Lit, and she'd be feeling the weight of his wounded, angry eyes all day long. Now that Tick is sure about Candace's motives, it angers her, and before she can consider the wisdom of doing so, she says, "I've changed too. The biggest change is that I don't like him anymore." Candace's response to this is to let loose the loudest scream Tick has ever heard. John Voss, at the other end of the table, actually looks up from his egg. Something metallic rattles onto the floor next to Tick's clog, and Candace, howling, "Oh my God, oh my God," holds up her hand, which is gushing blood from a deep gash that extends from her thumbnail almost to her palm. The blood is everywhere, down her arm, in the elaborate grooves she's been carving in the back of her chair, even a small pink drop on Tick's snake. Looking at all the blood, Tick feels her own left arm begin to throb the way it always does in anticipation of hypodermic needles at the doctor's office and at horror movies when somebody gets slashed. Candace, still screaming, wraps her thumb in the palm of her other hand and bends rapidly back and forth at the waist like one of those mechanical birds sipping water in an imaginary pool. There's blood down the front of her unicorn shirt now, and the cowards at the green table have all gotten up and moved away to the back wall. Tick's left arm now hurts so bad that she's beginning to feel lightheaded, and the whole room takes on an odd sheen, blurred at the edges like a television dream sequence. She leans forward, resting her forehead on the cool metal table and listening to Candace shriek until another voice, sounding far off, joins in, and a new pair of feet appear next to Candace's. Tick identifies them as Mrs. Rodriguez, and way off she hears the woman shouting, "Take your hand away so I can see, child," and then, "Who did this to you?" Now Candace is screaming, "I'm sorry, oh my God, I'm so sorry." Tick, confused, concludes that Candace must be talking to her, apologizing for acting as Zach Minty's go-between. "It's okay," Tick says, or imagines saying, probably, since she's unable to lift her head from the table to speak. In any case, it's what she would like to say, because she's the kind of person who forgives easily, who in fact cannot bear to think of a person wanting to be forgiven and having that forgiveness withheld. And so the words, "It's okay," spoken or unspoken, ring in her ears along with the rush of her own blood. When it seems the pain in her left arm can't get any worse without the arm itself exploding, the pain peaks, and then everything gradually becomes vague. Tick, now sweating and shivering, fears that for things to right themselves again, she'll have to cross back through that territory of pain, and the truth is she'd rather not. She'd rather pass out. Only when she opens her eyes does she realize she's been clenching them tightly shut for some time. With her forehead still on the cool edge of the table, she has a view of the floor at her feet. There, between her right foot and her backpack, is the bloody X-Acto knife. Candace's screaming has stopped, and there's no sign of her pink Adidas's. Mrs. Rodriguez, who seems to have gone away somewhere and come back again, is urging Tick to raise her head, and this time she discovers that she can. She's even more surprised to see that the room has emptied and that all the kids are clustered out in the hall, peering in at her. According to the clock on the wall, 10 minutes have passed. Mrs. Rodriguez is running her thumb along the metal edge of Candace's chair, apparently trying to locate a surface sharp enough to slice a kid's thumb open to the bone. The principal, Mr. Meyer, elbows his way into the room, then comes over and puts his hand on Tick's forehead. "I wouldn't get too close," Mrs. Rodriguez says. "She looks like she might puke." Mr. Meyer reacts visibly to this intelligence, though Tick can't tell for sure whether he's startled by that possibility or by his teacher's crudeness. "I think I'm okay," Tick says, in case it's the former that's worrying her principal. "What happened?"
"You fainted, Angel," Mr. Meyer said, making her like him for the very first time. "The sight of all that..."
He breaks off his thought, worried perhaps that the word blood might have the same effect as the sight itself.
"You want me to call your mom and dad?"
He catches himself as soon as he says this,
probably remembering that her parents are separated. Tick, wiggling the fingers of her left hand, repeats that she thinks she's going to be all right. The fingers now feel like they're being poked by 1,000 needles, but otherwise there's no pain, which means she's going to come out of this in a new place, which is a relief, not having to enter that same dark tunnel of pain again. After instructing her to remain where she is, Mr. Meyer takes Mrs. Rodriguez aside. Tick is still able to overhear small snatches of their conversation. Mrs. Rodriguez explaining how Candace told her she'd sliced her thumb open. Now it's Mr. Meyer's turn to examine the back of the chair, turning it upside down, running his own thumb along the metal surfaces tentatively, as if he isn't sure whether he really wants to solve this mystery or not. Tick reaches under the table, as if for her backpack, picks up the X-Acto knife, and slips it into one of the open side pouches. When she straightens up, shouldering her backpack, Mr. Meyer takes her gently by the elbow and guides her toward the door. There she catches a glimpse of Zach Minty out in the corridor, and a wave of nausea passes over her quickly, her knees wobbly for a second, and Mr. Meyer catches her around the waist. Normally, Tick hates being touched, especially by adults, but this time she's grateful. "The nurse's room for you, young lady," Mr. Meyer says, steering her in the right direction. It occurs to Tick then that she and Candace have sink duty this week, and they haven't done their cleanup, which Mrs. Rodriguez has made clear is the most important part of the whole artistic process. When she glances back into the room, she sees Mrs. Rodriguez standing at the blue table, as if to suggest that it's safe to visit Blue now that its artists are all gone. She's looking at Tick's snake with an expression of extreme distaste. Chapter 5. The donut shop in Empire Falls had always been one of Max Roby's favorite places because of its smoking policy, which was, "Go ahead, see if we care." Miles wondered what his father was going to do next year when all main restaurants would by law become smoke-free. For the present, there was still a cigarette machine by the door, and with only 8 booths and a counter with 6 stools, there could be no non-smoking section, which pleased the old man even more than being allowed to light up. Max was the kind of guy who created his own atmosphere, and he took particular pleasure, it seemed to Miles, in knowing that other people had to breathe his air when he was done with it. Actually, smoking was only one manifestation of this phenomenon. Max had always enjoyed breaking his own containment. He liked to stand close to people when he talked, and when he was eating, food had a way of becoming airborne. Now at 70, he'd developed a sweet tooth. He would have eaten chocolate bars if his teeth had allowed it, but half of them were gone, and the other half loose. So he settled for sugared donuts. By the time Max was finished with one, Miles, who usually just drank coffee, often found his entire shirt front dusted with confectioner's sugar. Many years ago, Miles had asked his mother what had attracted her to a man with such disgusting personal habits, and she'd replied that his father hadn't always been this way, certainly not as a young man. Miles loved his mother and would have liked to believe her, but it wasn't easy. All her life she'd been a woman who, once she gave her heart, would ignore anything dismaying. But Miles suspected she'd learned to overlook Max entirely in order to stay married to him. Still, by the time Miles asked, she was clearly mortified by her choice of a mate. "You'd never guess it to look at him now," she told her son, "but your father had the most infectious smile." Infectious, Miles could believe. Like most kids, when Miles and his brother were growing up, they brought a great variety of illnesses home from school. Chickenpox, mumps, measles, routine colds and flus. David proved particularly susceptible to whatever was going around and stayed sick longer than Miles did. But neither boy could be described as sickly, except when their father brought something home and shared it with them. Then everyone but Max himself went down for the mandatory 8 count. Whatever the virus, it became several degrees more deadly in his pulmonary system until he finally reintroduced it into the atmosphere by means of his explosive sneezes. Max regarded covering his mouth as irrational behavior. The way he looked at it, you might as well cover your ass with your hand when you farted. See how much good that did. Miles watched his father light a fresh cigarette with his old one before crushing out the butt in the ashtray he'd managed to half-fill in 20 minutes. Miles studied his father's mouth, trying to imagine a full set of white teeth and that infectious grin, but it was no use. One of the great unsolved mysteries of the universe, Miles had long believed, was what women found attractive about certain men. Apparently, women all over the world wanted to have sex with Mick Jagger, or at least had wanted to once upon a time. Others had not found Max Roby repulsive. Miles couldn't help admiring women for their ability to dismiss the evidence of their senses, if that's what explained it. If it wasn't simply that from time to time, they were unaccountably drawn to the grotesque. Outside, it was drizzling again, as it had the day before, just hard enough to make painting impossible. Half an hour earlier, Miles, heading back to the restaurant, had seen his father sitting on one of the benches outside the senior citizen's tower, talking to an old woman who seemed to be wondering what she'd done to deserve his company and how she might avoid making the same mistake in the future. "Just keep driving," Miles had said out loud, even as he pulled the Jetta over and tooted the horn. No good deed, he reminded himself as Max hopped up from the bench and came toward him across the newly seeded lawn, goes unpunished. Nor would this one, Miles added to himself, studying his father across the booth. "You've got crumbs in your beard, Dad," he pointed out. "Did you know that?" Max shaved only every third or fourth day, and he never ironed the clothes he abandoned in the communal dryers of the tower's complex until one of the other residents removed and returned them. The result was a web of crazy pleats and wrinkles in everything he wore. "So what?" the old man wanted to know, drawing in another lungful of smoke, then expelling it off to the side in deference to Miles, who didn't smoke. As if the air weren't blue all around them. As if Miles and David hadn't smoked the equivalent of a pack a day since they were babies whenever their father was around. "You look like an idiot is what," Miles told him. "People are going to take one look at you and conclude you're as senile as Father Tom." Actually, next to Max, Father Tom looked positively elegant. Max appeared to consider this possibility for a full beat before dismissing it. "You should let me help you out with the church," he said, reminded of this desire by Miles' reference to the old priest. Painting the church was a subject Miles considered closed and Max considered wide open.
"I did paint houses for 40 years, you know. I'm supposed to go down to the Keys in another month. How do you expect me to do that if I don't have any money?"
"I don't think helping me paint is a good idea, Dad," Miles said. "Last month you fell off a bar stool. I don't want you falling off any ladders."
"That's different," his father explained. "I was drunk."
"Right," Miles said, "as I'm sure you'll be when you fall off the ladder." His father nodded agreeably, and if Miles hadn't known better, he'd have sworn Max had given in. But when the old man exhaled this time, he didn't turn his head.
"If I had a few bucks in my pocket, I wouldn't have to hit you up all the time, you know."
The waitress appeared, refilled their coffee cups, and departed again in one fluid motion, suggesting to Miles that she was dead set against lingering in Max Roby's proximity.
"Did you hear what I said?"
his father wanted to know. "I heard you, Dad," Miles answered, emptying a packet of sweetener into his coffee. "But you keep forgetting that I'm painting St. Cat's for free." His father shrugged.
"That doesn't mean you can't pay me."
"Yes, it does, Dad," Miles said. "That's precisely what it means." The last thing Miles wanted was Max working alongside him at the church. Every time Max saw Father Mark, he'd rag him about how cheap Catholics were. He reasoned that since the Vatican was rich, all priests, by virtue of being employed by the Vatican, could write checks at will. How could the church have all those millions stashed away and not be able to afford to pay two poor house painters in Empire Falls, Maine? That's what he'd want Father Mark to explain. Actually, the question would be rhetorical, since Max would allow Father Mark about 2 seconds before explaining how the church operated this scam. Every week, he'd argue, you collect money from people who don't know any better than to give it to you. And then you put it in a bank halfway around the world where nobody from Empire Falls, Maine, is likely to look for it, much less find it. If anybody ever asks you for part of it back, say, to have your own damn church painted, you tell them the money's all gone, that you're as poor as they are, that you gave the money in question to the bishop, who gave it to the cardinal, who gave it to the pope.
In my next life, Max would conclude, that's who I want to be, the pope. And I'll do the same thing he does. I'll keep all the goddamn money.
Miles enjoyed scripting scenes like this, mostly because doing so helped him to avoid them in reality.
If you paid me for work, continued Max, whose rhetoric was more sophisticated than you might expect from a man with food in his beard, I wouldn't have to feel worthless. There's no law says all people have to feel worthless all the while, you know. You paid me, I'd have some dignity.
Now it was Miles' turn to nod and smile agreeably. I think the dignity ship set sail a long time ago, Dad. Max grinned, then finished stirring his coffee and used his spoon to point at his son, who felt a couple stray drops of coffee fleck his shirt front.
You're trying to hurt my feelings, his father said knowingly. But you can.
Miles dabbed a wet paper napkin on the spots. Besides, Dad, he said, any time you feel like an infusion of dignity, you can come down to the restaurant and wash dishes for a while.
That's your idea of dignity? Coop your old man up in that little room with no windows for hours, washing dishes for minimum wage, half of which goes to the government?
Which Max would do eventually, when he got needy enough. Miles was in no hurry to have him give in, either, since the old man was a careless, resentful worker. In his opinion, any dish that came out of the Hobart was clean by definition, no matter if it was stained yellow with egg yolk. He hated, even more than the claustrophobic room, Miles' refusal to pay him under the table. He reckoned that if you could paint a whole house under the table, and he had all his working life, then you ought to be able to wash a few dishes under there, too. In Max's view, Grace had raised their son to be morally fastidious just to spite him. Had he foreseen such moral inflexibility, he'd have taken more of a personal interest in the boy's education. But unfortunately, he hadn't noticed until it was too late. His other son, David, had more give to him, thank God.
I'd let you hire me at the restaurant if I could come out and work the counter now and then, Max said. There's nothing to flipping a burger, you know, and I like talking to people.
I'd have to run you through the Hobart first, Miles told him. Rinse some of the crumbs out of your beard. You don't seem to understand that people come into the Empire Grill to eat, and you're a walking appetite suppressant.
I may be simpy, his father continued without missing a beat, but I can still climb like a monkey.
Back to painting the church again. The old man was nimble, Miles had to admit, both afoot and of conversation. Miles had given up trying to corner him long ago. Max's persistence about the church was curious, though. 30 years ago, when Father Tom had hired another contractor to paint St. Catherine's, his father had vowed never to set foot on the grounds again. Of course, he hadn't set foot inside for a decade anyway, leaving his wife and son, David wasn't yet born, to attend services. The way Max saw it, though, was that everything his wife and son did, they did under his aegis, and the contractor Father Tom had hired was a damn Presbyterian, not even remotely connected to the parish. Maybe Max wasn't a practicing Catholic himself, but he was married to one who practiced every minute of her life, even though she had it all down pat. Also, he'd bred another little Catholic, and that should have counted too. Still, Max was true to his pledge, which now caused Miles to wonder. Was his desire to help paint the church some kind of oblique regret? Miles had never known his father to indulge regret in any form, though he'd had more than his fair share of opportunities. After all, Max had made a poor effort at being a father, and an even poorer one at being a husband. In truth, he wasn't even much of a house painter. He didn't like to scrape, and he laid the paint on thick and sloppy. He preferred sitting in bars to painting houses, and so, to proceed from the former to the latter, he liked to work fast, even in circumstances that cried out for deliberation. He painted windows shut and couldn't be bothered to wipe the glass off with a rag if he'd managed to swipe it with a brush. In any other man his age, a desire to paint the church might have represented nothing more than a longing to spend some time with his neglected son. But Miles doubted this was the case with Max, who'd never given much evidence of enjoying the company of either of his sons, though he did appreciate anyone who'd spring for a donut so he could put the price of the donut toward a pack of cigarettes. No, the only conclusion that Miles could come to was that old age generally played havoc with your personality. Father Tom, for instance, who had always assigned the hearing of confessions to the junior priests, now, in his dotage, pleaded with Father Mark to let him hear just a few. If the younger priest wasn't vigilant on Saturday afternoons, he'd look up and find the old priest had disappeared, and then would have to hurry across the lawn between the rectory and the church to the dark confessional, where the old man would be patiently awaiting further revelations from his parishioners, curious now, in his old age, about what people were up to, and eager to share what he'd learned. It was from Father Tom that Miles first learned his wife was carrying on with Walt Como.
I'll tell you another thing, too. Once I'm up on a ladder, I don't get scared like some little girl.
Works both ways, Dad, Miles reminded him. You can't hurt my feelings either.
Never meant to, the old man said, exhibiting a kind of straightforward insincerity that was in its own way endearing. When did you become such a damn sissy about heights is what I'd like to know. I'm 70 and I can still climb like a monkey, and you're what? 42.
Max stubbed out his cigarette, as if at least the question of his son's age had been established beyond question.
42 and afraid to climb a stepladder. I fell 2 damn stories once, and I'm not scared.
Finish your coffee, Dad, Miles said. I need to get back to the restaurant.
I fell off a scaffold over on Division Street. 2 damn stories and landed on my ass in the middle of a rose bush. Try that sometime. That don't mean I'm afraid to climb a ladder anymore.
Outside, a police cruiser pulled into the parking lot, and Miles saw it was Jimmy Minty at the wheel. He could feel the cruiser's front bumper actually nudge the side of the building, causing the Formica booth as well as its ashtrays to shudder. Instead of getting out, Jimmy, in uniform today, just sat there, his lips moving as if in conversation with an invisible companion. Only when he leaned forward to hang up the receiver did it dawn on Miles that he'd been talking into his radio. This made 3 times in 2 days that their paths had crossed. Coincidentally, well, it was possible.
I could help you rig the platforms, at least, his father was saying. That way you'd know you were standing on something solid.
I know how to rig scaffolding, Dad.
I should hope so, Max said. I'm the one taught you how, in case you forgot.
I didn't forget.
I let you help, if you recall. If your mother had known, she'd have had a fit. But I let you help anyway. Now I need some traveling expenses, and you tell me to take a hike.
I never said,
I gotta pay, his father said disgustedly, sliding out of the booth, as if the conversation, not the coffee, had caused this unfortunate need to relieve himself.
The restroom door had no sooner closed behind Max than Jimmy Minty slipped into the booth, setting his shiny black hat on the table. His red hair was going a little gray at the temples, Miles noticed. The waitress set a cup of coffee in front of him. I wish you wouldn't run into that wall every time you pull in, Jimmy, she said. You scare the hell out of people. One minute they're drinking coffee and minding their own business, and the next minute you're parking in the booth with them. It's not like the side of this damn building's invisible. The idea is to stop before you get to it.
You need to get a couple of those concrete curbs out there, Minty smiled. I bet I'm not the only one who taps that wall, Shirley.
No, she admitted. You're just the only one who hits it every time.
When she stepped away, the policeman shrugged. Hey, Miles, I thought that was your Jetta out there. You should have spent the extra for the undercoating. What would it have run you? A couple hundred?
It never took Jimmy Minty long to turn any conversation to one about money. He particularly liked to draw Miles' attention to whatever was wrong with any of his possessions, such as rust on the Jetta, of which there was plenty. Miles had long suspected that Jimmy Minty considered him some kind of yardstick by which he might measure his own economic well-being. The oddest thing about this, Miles thought, was that it seemed a direct extension of their childhoods on Long Street. Jimmy Minty had always taken careful inventory of Miles's belongings, wanting to know how much everything cost and where it was purchased. If they got similar Christmas presents, Jimmy liked to explain why his was better, that it had been purchased smarter and cheaper because his dad knew where to go, even if the toy in question was obviously a cheap knockoff. After detailing the advantages of his present, he'd suggest they switch, just for a while. Often, before Jimmy returned it, Miles's toy would get broken. Even 30 years later, Miles could still remember the relief he felt when his mother took him out of the public grade school and enrolled him at Sacred Heart, where Jimmy, the family was not Catholic, could not follow. Gradually, though they remained neighbors, the boys' lives began to drift apart, and by the time they were thrown together again in high school, they had different lives, different friends. Of course, Jimmy's, as he explained to Miles, were better. After graduation, he did a stint in the service while Miles was away at college, and by the time Miles returned to Empire Falls, Jimmy was newly married and living in Fairhaven. He visited his parents, though, and after Miles and Janine got married, he made overtures about striking up their old friendship, something Miles didn't particularly desire, since the grown-up Jimmy Minty had the same way of taking inventory behind his eyes, only now he was comparing wives. For the last decade, they had seldom seen each other, except in moving vehicles or when Jimmy had a new toy he wanted to show off in the Empire Grill. The last time, a year ago, he'd ordered a steak and then lingered at the counter drinking coffee until Miles deigned to notice the red Camaro parked out front. On any such occasion, Jimmy would assure Miles that he was doing all right for himself, despite having been denied opportunities like college. If he kept his nose clean, he didn't see any reason he shouldn't be the next chief of police of Empire Falls. His son Zach, though, he was going to have it made.
That's your dad I saw you with?
Jimmy wondered now, nodding toward the men's room.
You know it was. You sat right there.
Miles nodded through the window at the cruiser, staring at us.
The light was reflecting off the glass, Minty said. It could have been anybody.
Hell of a guess, then.
Sorry about yesterday, he said,
apparently in reference to the young police officer who had interrogated Miles on Long Street.
New kid, still learning the ropes. Good thing I happened by, though. You talk back to him or something?
Not even remotely.
Minty shrugged.
Well, you pissed him off somehow. Good thing I turned up when I did.
This second reference to his good fortune, Miles realized, was intended as another chance for Miles to express his gratitude. That he should fail to take advantage of it was visibly disappointing, but Jimmy seemed determined to get over it.
Breaks your heart, doesn't it? He said. The old neighborhood?
Miles tried to navigate their talk into the calmer waters of generality. The whole town, for that matter. Jimmy Minty's surprised, even hurt expression suggested that he considered this indictment of Empire Falls far too sweeping.
I still like it here, he said. I can't help it, I just do. People say there are better places, but I don't know.
He paused in case Miles wanted to rattle off a list of supposedly better places. Long Street, though, that's different. I get called up there all the time these days. Nothing but wife-beaters and drug dealers anymore.
Wife-beaters aren't anything new, Miles reminded him, since Jimmy's own father, William, had been known to settle marital differences in this fashion. Jimmy ignored him.
Hell, the place you were parked out front of is the biggest drug house in town.
He lowered his voice now.
We've been monitoring who goes in and out for a while. I guess Officer Pollard thought you were there to make a score.
Miles couldn't help smiling. Somebody should tell him he'll have better luck, evidence-wise, if he waits until suspects come out instead of busting them on the way in.
That's what I told him. You got to admit, though, that Jetta of yours does look like a drugmobile.
Really? How's that?
Minty shrugged.
No offense, but it's the kind of vehicle the owner won't mind that much if it's impounded.
I'd mind. It's the only car I own.
Jimmy Minty looked like he could just kick himself.
Damn, I guess I hurt your feelings.
Not at all, Miles smiled. The other man puzzled over how this could be for several beats.
You want to know a secret?
The honest answer to this was no, so Miles said nothing.
What you were doing over there yesterday? I do the same thing sometimes.
What's that?
You know, just drive over, sit in the car, and try to figure it all out.
All what out? Miles asked, genuinely curious. Minty shrugged.
Life, I guess. The way things turn out. I guess some people would think it's pretty weird, me ending up a cop.
Not me, Jimmy. Minty studied him carefully, perhaps suspecting an insult.
My dad and all is what I meant. It's true. He did slap my mom around a little. That's what you meant a minute ago, right? And I guess we did have a freezer full of meat out back that wasn't always taken in season. Shit like that. But I miss him anyway. You only get one father, is the way I look at it. Even though now, looking back, I can see where he crossed the line. Anyway, a cop's what I turned out to be, weird or not. God probably had a hand in it, I guess.
I suppose it's possible.
Jimmy nodded.
Take you. If your mother hadn't got sick when she did, you probably never would have come back here at all, am I right?
Miles allowed that this too was possible.
That's what I mean. Sometimes I drive over to the old neighborhood and just sit there.
He paused.
I always think about your ma. Pretty awful way for anybody to die.
Can we change the subject? Miles said.
Hell yeah. Jimmy Minty straightened up and shook his head. I don't know what got me started on all this. Seeing you just sitting there yesterday, I guess, and thinking how we used to be friends. All that water over the dam. How's that cute little girl of yours?
Good, Miles told him. Happier than she's been in a while.
Since she stopped going out with your son, was what Miles didn't say.
If Jimmy Minty intuited the omission, he gave no sign.
Want to know another secret? I gotta think my Zach's still a little sweet on her, he said, letting the words hang in the air between them, as if inviting Miles to betray either enthusiasm or aversion. Of course, with kids, you never know. I told him at the time he should have let her down gentler. Treat people the way you want to be treated is my motto. You can't go too far wrong. Not that you can tell kids their age anything.
Hearing the men's room door open behind him, Miles allowed himself a half smile. Few social situations were improved by Max Roby's participation, but this was one of them.
I keep telling him if he doesn't start paying attention to his grades, no college is going to want him. But no, he's got all that figured out, just like they all do. Not that I blame him, exactly. He looks at me, and I'm doing all right without college. Hell, better than all right, really. So he figures, what the hell?
Jimmy Minty paused again.
What our kids don't understand is we want even better for them, not just as good. Am I right?
Max's return spared Miles the necessity of agreeing with him.
Jimmy Minty,
said Max, sitting down on the bench seat and forcing the policeman to slide down next to the window. Max looked at him with what appeared to be total bewilderment.
My God, what a stupid kid you were growing up.
Go easy, Dad, Miles said. He's carrying a gun these days.
I just hope he's smarter than he was back then, Max said, offering a paw to the policeman. How the hell are you, Jimmy?
Minty looked at the proffered hand as if he doubted Max had washed it in the men's room, but shook it anyway.
How you doing, Mr. Roby?
Speaking to Miles now, as he and Jimmy Minty shook, Max said,
You remember what a stupid kid he was? My God, it was pitiful. I don't think I can remember another child so untalented.
Minty seemed to want his hand back now, but didn't know how to get it. And Miles shrugged at him, as if to suggest he had no idea what possessed his father to act the way he did.
It was enough to make you cry, Max said, finally letting go of the man's hand.
Minty seemed to be weighing the dangers and benefits of asking just what he'd done to warrant such a low opinion.
I suppose it should be a lesson to us all, Max observed. Never give up on a child, because even the ones you have to tie their shoes for on their wedding day could surprise you and end up gainfully employed.
Max, with a face almost beatific, delivered this lesson as if to suggest he meant the whole thing as a compliment, causing the officer to knit his brow in confusion. He was almost sure he was being insulted, but not quite. Miles, of course, had often seen his father smile and chuckle and slap men on the back, continuing to insult them until they finally had no choice but to punch him. Only the smartest popped him right away. Once Max had established that whatever he said was all in good fun, it was hard to break free of that context. Miles also knew that the target of his father's ridicule often turned on a dime, so he wasn't surprised when it did so now.
My son here is the opposite, Max explained. Always at the top of his class. Straight A's right through school. You'd have sworn he'd go places.
Miles sighed, resigned to his inevitable drubbing. Before, Max had insulted Jimmy Minty while looking at Miles. Now, insulting his son, he was, of course, speaking directly at the previous object of his scorn.
There's nothing harder to figure out than a kid, Max was telling him, as if he'd spent the better part of a long, largely contemplative life studying this question. I'd have bet that Miles here would have grown up to have a good heart. If his father was on his uppers and needed a hand and asked his own son for a job, he'd help pronto. But apparently not.
You about ready to go, Dad?
No, I'm talking to Jimmy Minty. Go ahead if you want.
Miles caught the eye of the waitress and signaled for the check.
Jimmy here may not have been gifted like you, but I bet you he understands what I'm saying.
Minty's brow furrowed even deeper at this second reference to his intellectual limitations, even though Max had safely located these in the past.
You see, Jimmy, I asked my son to let me help him paint our old church, so I'd have the money to go down to the Keys, but for some reason he won't hire me. I can still climb like a monkey, too.
Having slid a $5 bill onto the table, Miles stood to go. You sure you don't want to lift home, Dad? I'm not coming back for you, so don't bother calling me at the restaurant.
I don't intend to call you, his father assured him. Besides, Jimmy Minty here can give me a lift in the cruiser.
Actually, that's against the rules, Minty said. He was looking even more boxed in now that Miles had vacated his side of the booth. That left him and Max sitting way too close, and he knew how this would look to other people. Two men crammed together like that on the same side of a small booth, one of them with crumbs in his beard.
Hell, I can understand that, Max conceded,
waving good riddance to Miles and looking like a man who had no intention of moving.
Rules are rules. They may be dumb, and the people you hire to enforce them may be dumber yet. But what can you do? The law's the law. There's no law says a man's own son can't help him out when he needs it. That's all I'm saying. There's no law against that.
Outside, Miles got into the car and turned the key in the ignition, determined to ignore the knocking on the window of the donut shop. His father, having made his point, now decided to unmake it, since the truth was that he probably did want to lift somewhere. Besides, he hadn't hit Miles up for a loan yet, either. Sitting in the Jetta, pretending not to hear the frantic knocking, Miles supposed he understood his father's thinking better than Max did himself. The thing to do was put the car in reverse, back out of the parking space, and drive off. Teach the old man a lesson. Maybe because he was grateful to Max for giving Jimmy Minty such a hard time, he gave up the pretense and acknowledged hearing the knocking on the window. He was immediately glad that he did, for the scene framed in the window was priceless. In order to rap on the glass, Max had to lean across the booth in such a way that his moist, fragrant armpit was practically covering the policeman's face. Miles couldn't help but smile. He was grateful for his father's existence, just as Minty had told him he should be. Sighing, he waved for Max to come along, which the old man would do, Miles knew, in his own sweet time. His feet flat on the floor beside the Jetta's pedals, Miles felt some give in the metal beneath the worn carpet, which suggested that the rust was eating away at the chassis. Minty was right about that, too. He should have sprung for the undercoating. As he watched the two men slide out of the booth, he realized that Jimmy Minty hadn't been telling the truth about light reflecting off the donut shop window. Everything on the other side of the glass possessed the stark clarity of an Edward Hopper painting, which meant that Jimmy had pretended to be unable to see what had been plainly visible. A silly lie. A lie so small and to so little purpose that it suggested to Miles a way of life, a strategy for confronting the world, and this was further reason, if any was needed, to doubt the truth of everything the man had said inside. As Minty paid the bill at the register, and Max bought a pack of cigarettes from the machine, Miles tasted something on the back of his tongue. Too much coffee mingling with stomach acid, probably. Either that, or anger mingling with fear. Miles swallowed hard, forcing down whatever it was. The two men pushed through the door onto the sidewalk, and Miles noticed that both had acquired toothpicks.
"You're okay, Jimmy," Miles heard his father say. "I'll tell you the God's honest truth. I'd rather have a complete idiot for a son than an ingrate."
Instead of getting into the cruiser, Minty came around the Jetta and motioned for Miles to roll down the window.
"Take a little walk with me," he suggested, his voice low, confidential.
"I really need to get back to the restaurant," Miles told him.
"Won't take a minute." "Go ahead," Max said. "I'll just sit here by myself and wait. You go with Jimmy Minty and swap secrets."
Miles followed the policeman over to his patrol car, where he rolled the toothpick in his mouth as if considering how to begin. "I shouldn't be doing this, but we go back a long ways," he said. "I was going to mention it back inside, but then your old man came back and I didn't want to worry him."
"What is it, Jimmy?"
"Here's the deal," Minty said, working his toothpick. "There's a lot of dope around town right now. Tell your brother to be careful."
Miles felt himself instantly bristle, more at the presumed intimacy than the implied accusation.
"Why should David be careful?"
"Hey, I understand he's your brother. I'm just saying."
"No, Jimmy, what are you saying?"
"I'm just... nothing. Forget it. I'm just saying word to the wise is all."
The toothpick still twirled thoughtfully. Miles considered grabbing it and running it through the man's bottom lip and tying it there in a splintered knot.
"And I can't help thinking how bad your ma would feel if..."
Rather than punch an armed cop in broad daylight in the middle of Empire Avenue, Miles turned on his heel and strode back to the Jetta. The suddenness of this movement apparently caught his father by surprise as he was rummaging through the Jetta's glove box. This discovery had the unintended effect of sending Miles back to Jimmy Minty, who hadn't moved.
"Look," he said, "you don't know the first thing about my mother, okay? So don't bring her up in any more conversations."
"Hey,
no, shut up and listen, Jimmy," Miles said, feeling his fury rise in his throat. The taste was anger, after all, not fear, and the blood pounding in his cheeks. "You didn't Know her. Say it for me, so I know you understand. Jimmy Minty's face had gone pale.
Hey, okay, I didn't really know your mother.
Fine, Miles said, some of the rage draining out of him, replaced by the knowledge that he'd overreacted. Terrific.
You shouldn't tell me to shut up, Miles, Minty said. Not out here in public like this. This uniform entitles me to some respect.
You're right, Miles admitted, flushed with shame yet unwilling to surrender his anger. You're right, and I'm sorry. Just don't pretend you knew my mother.
Hey, I thought she was a great lady. That's all I was saying.
But he must have seen Miles' color rising again because he stopped. Your brother should be careful is all I'm saying, okay? Everybody knows he's growing marijuana out there and...
See?
Miles said. That's where you're wrong. Everybody does not know that. I don't know that, for instance. Which was true. He didn't know it, not for sure.
How come you're getting so bent out of shape, Miles? I try to do you and your brother a favor.
No, Miles interrupted him, feeling suddenly calm. I don't believe that. I have no idea what you're trying to do, Jimmy. I don't know why I'm suddenly seeing you everywhere I turn lately. I don't know why my name should come up in your conversation with Mrs. Whiting at the courthouse either.
Minty squinted at this, then glanced away.
But I do know you aren't looking out for my well-being. That much I'm sure of. So from now on, if you want to do me a favor, stay away from me and my family. That goes for your kid, too. There are lots of girls in Empire Falls. As far as I'm concerned, he can choose anyone he likes. There's just one he can't have, and that's Tick.
A sly smile began to steal over the policeman's features, and Miles turned away, fearing the temptation to remove it.
How come you don't like me, Miles? Minty called after him. I've always wondered why.
Miles answered without turning around. Call it the habit of a lifetime. Back in the Jetta, Miles waited to turn the key in the ignition until Minty's cruiser disappeared down the avenue.
God, what a prize dunce he was, Max recalled fondly.
He wasn't stupid, Dad. He was sneaky and mean and envious and dangerous. He still is.
Don't get mad at me, his father said. It's Jimmy Minty you're mad at. I'm just a useless old man.
Miles put the car in reverse. Did you find what you were looking for in the glove box?
I borrowed $10, his father said sheepishly. I was gonna mention it, but you never gave me the chance.
Right.
I was, Max insisted, perhaps truthfully.
He did sometimes tell the truth if it suited his purpose.
If you'd hire me, I wouldn't have to be broke all the while. If I could make some money, you'd get rid of me for the winter.
Before pulling out, Miles craned his neck forward to look down Empire Avenue to make sure no traffic was coming. When he and his mother used to walk downtown for a Saturday matinee at the old Bijou Theater, the sidewalks had been so crowded, the streets so clogged with vehicles, that pedestrians had to turn sideways to pass by one another. They crossed the street between cars backed up for blocks from the traffic light. Now Empire Avenue was empty all the way down to the old shirt factory. No trespassing, without permission. Where Miles' mother had worked so they could afford the rent on the little house on Long Street, in the dark upper bedroom of which, after her cancer returned for the final time, she'd scream her agony so loudly the neighbors could hear her. Of course Jimmy Minty had heard those screams. Miles himself had heard them all the way down in Portland, in his small Catholic college, and hearing them he'd hurried home, even though she'd begged him not to. Looking down the deserted street, Miles couldn't help feeling that everyone in town must have heard her terrible screams. His brother, a mere boy, had fled into the bottle. His father to the Florida Keys. It was almost possible to believe that these two were responsible for the mass exodus that by now had lasted more than two decades, a panicky flight from pain that emptied out the town.
You can drop me off at Callahan's, Max suggested.
Miles blinked, then turned to stare at his father. You mean Callahan's right there? He said, pointing at the red brick tavern across the street, his mother-in-law's place.
Right.
For that, you wanted a lift?
Maybe I wanted to spend some time with my son. Or is there some law against that, too?
Miles sighed. The old man was truly without conscience.
How come you got a Martha's Vineyard real estate guide in there? His father wondered, pointing at the glove box.
Is there a law against that? Miles said. Max ignored this.
Be just like you to move to some island and leave me here without a job. I ever wanted to see you, I'd have to swim.
I'm not going anywhere, Dad. You said so yourself, Miles reminded him. It was just a week's vacation.
You could have taken me along, you know. I might like a vacation myself. Did that ever occur to you?
Miles pulled across the street into Callahan's parking lot. When his father started to get out, Miles said, Dad, you still got crumbs in your beard.
So what? Said Max,
closing the door on the possibility of enlightenment. Chapter 6 I don't think Mrs. Rodrigue likes my snake, Tick confessed to her father. It was a Thursday in mid-September, and on Thursday nights, she and Miles always had dinner together, since Janine usually worked the desk at the fitness club until 8, and Tick refused to eat with the Silver Fox. At the Empire Grill, Thursday nights also meant Chinese. Tonight, David had on special something called twice-cooked noodles with scallops and hoisin sauce. His brother's more adventurous concoctions always made Miles smile in memory of old Roger Sperry, whose favorite special had always been deep-fried haddock with tartar sauce, whipped potatoes with beef gravy, a side of applesauce, and Parker House rolls. His theory of noodles, which Roger didn't often put into practice, was to leave them in boiling water until you were sure they were cooked. Then you wouldn't need to cook them again. It was also his firm conviction that there wasn't much point in fighting a world war if you were going to come home and start serving things in hoisin sauce, whatever that was. That was the sort of thing you'd do if you lost the damn war. Roger would never have made a distinction between the Japanese, with whom we'd been engaged in armed conflict, and the Chinese, with whom we had not. Miles himself had had some doubts about international nights when his brother first proposed them as part of his plan to attract out-of-town business, something they'd have to do if the restaurant were going to survive the local economy. For a while, Friday and Saturday nights didn't show a profit, but David had correctly predicted that good, cheap ethnic food would eventually attract students and junior faculty from Fairhaven, who would consider the grill's worn-out, cigarette-burned countertop and wobbly booths honest or retro or some damn thing. Tonight was only the second Thursday they'd served Chinese, to augment their Friday Italian and Saturday Mexican, and Miles was pleased to see the restaurant nearly full of people, many of them new faces, who seemed willing to entertain the possibility that noodles might benefit from a second cooking. When a brief lull occurred, David turned away from the stove, leaned on his spatula, and searched out Miles' eye, raising an eyebrow. Not bad. Miles nodded. Not bad. In fact, tonight it all seemed better than not bad. Granted, his first week back from the vineyard had been tough, but it usually was. Every year he left the island haunted by a profound feeling of personal failure. Was it the island itself that inspired this? Perhaps. More likely it had something to do with Peter and Dawn, who, without intending to, reminded him of who he'd wanted to be when they had all been students together. Of course, it was possible that they, too, were haunted by similar regrets. After all, back when they were undergraduates, Peter had wanted to be a playwright, Dawn a poet. Certainly the way they talked about their profession in television suggested they also wondered if they hadn't betrayed their original, deeper purpose. Maybe they even indulged the feeling, as Miles sometimes did, that they each must have a double in some parallel universe, happily living the life they'd imagined for themselves in their youth. But such self-indulgence was fraudulent. For one thing, Miles couldn't even be sure anymore if this alternate life was one he'd imagined or just one he'd inherited from his mother's hopes and wishes. From the time he was a boy,
He would look up from a book he was reading to find her quietly studying him. "My little scholar," she'd say, smiling. Later in college, he'd been greatly attracted to the exciting life his professors seemed to lead, richly furnished with books and ideas worth arguing over. And he'd thought that maybe his mother was right, that the life of the mind was his own truest destiny. One thing was for sure. He'd never aspired to feeding other professors twice-cooked noodles for a living. Over at the counter, Charlene was balancing plates up her forearm, and at this distance, she might almost have been the girl he'd had a crush on in high school. A girl so womanly at age 18 that she made Miles at 15 feel about 11. Looking at her now made it hard for him to claim he'd been an entirely unwilling participant in his own foiled destiny. Yes, he'd been attracted to the life of the mind, and no doubt his mother's idea of the man she thought he would become had shaped his own image of himself. But when she'd fallen ill, and he'd left school to return to Empire Falls and manage the grill for Mrs. Whiting, his doing so had not been entirely altruistic. True, he'd wanted to be near his mother, and yes, his brother was already exhibiting signs of trouble, but he'd also thought of Charlene, calculating that the 3 years' age difference wouldn't matter so much now, at 21 and 24. Though he told Mrs. Whiting he wanted to mull over her offer, by the time he'd hung up the phone, he'd already decided. That summer, Charlene's first husband had run off and left her, and Miles had thought maybe, just maybe. What he had no way of knowing then was that by the time he returned to Empire Falls, Charlene would already be engaged to husband number two. No, he certainly had not been an unwilling participant. And more to the point, if given an opportunity to rewrite the script, he would not be inclined to do so, at least not tonight, in this restaurant that would one day be his, sharing a booth with his daughter, whose destiny would not be tied to Empire Falls. Not if he had anything to say about it. That his mother had believed the same thing about his own destiny was vaguely disconcerting, but tonight he couldn't help feeling fortunate. For the first time in a decade, business was looking up. David appeared to have banished the worst of his demons. Tick, it seemed, would survive the divorce. There was much to be thankful for, even if the balance of things remained too precarious to inspire confidence. So on nights like this one, his life seemed almost enough. "But here's the thing," Tick was saying, using her fork as a baton to emphasize a point about her art teacher. Miles, studying the fork, was grateful that, unlike her grandfather, Tick was able to demonstrate ideas without flinging food. "What if she did like it? That'd be even worse. I mean, if she liked it, then I'd wonder what was wrong with it." Miles tried to suppress a smile but couldn't. His daughter's grasp of adult situations often staggered him. In this instance, she understood completely what the endorsement of a fool was worth. Miles had gone to high school with Doris Rodrigue, Doris Flynn back then, and he knew her mind had fused shut sometime during Catholic grade school. Nothing had happened since she was 12 that did anything except reinforce the conviction she already held. As a condition for keeping her job, the school district insisted that she attend summer school in Farmington, but these classes did little to shake the woman's defiant convictions, which she proudly maintained were uncorrupted by the university. In Bill Rodrigue, a local insurance man, she'd found her ideal mate, an infinitely patient fellow who never seemed to weary of her sense of thwarted superiority. Miles, after serving several terms on the school board, knew most of Tick's teachers and made it a matter of policy not to speak ill of them, regardless of how ignorant and narrow-minded they were. But with Doris Rodrigue, he was often tempted to make an exception. During the last 5 years, he'd run up against her on numerous occasions about curriculum, about books held in the library, about staffing. But since the day he'd invited her, in public meeting, to explain a single difference between the work of Andrew Wyeth and Jackson Pollock, and then used her startled confusion to suggest an explanation for why art history was not included in her courses, she'd steered clear of him. According to Tick,
The woman was steering clear of her as well. By putting her at the table composed of the least motivated students in the class, and then pretending the table didn't exist.
Keep in mind, Miles reminded her, it's not you she objects to, it's me. She probably thinks I'm trying to get her fired.
Are you?
Teachers can't be fired unless they molest their students, Miles told her. Doris hasn't been molesting anybody, has she?
But Tick had turned her attention back to her dinner, pushing the ingredients around on her plate thoughtfully, as if considering a better, more artistic use for food.
Has she made any specific criticisms of your snake?
That's the thing, Tick said happily, again wielding her fork as a baton. Lately, all her statements were preceded by variations on the thing. Here's the thing, that's the thing is...
I think what she doesn't like about my snake is that it reminds her of real snakes.
That's one possibility, Miles agreed. The other that occurred to him was more Freudian, though he didn't think his teenage daughter needed to start worrying about sexual repression just yet.
Which is interesting, Tick went on, because it means that the better I draw the snake, the more it will remind her of what she hates, and the worse grade I'll get. Hence... This word was another of Tick's new rhetorical devices. If I want a good grade, my strategy should be to draw the snake badly.
Or not draw a snake, Miles felt compelled to point out.
Except our assignment was to draw our most vivid dream, and that's my most vivid dream.
I understand, Miles said, but you mistrust your teacher's judgment about the merits of your snake, correct?
Correct.
Hence... Miles grinned. You might as well distrust the wisdom of the assignment, right? Draw her an angel. Mrs. Rodrigue would be cheered to think you're dreaming of angels. This was no guess either. Doris Rodrigue, who'd never seen the sense of separating church and state, openly encouraged work with religious themes.
But I'm dreaming of snakes.
What you're dreaming about is none of her business, Miles pointed out. A little surprised by his growing anger at the thought of trusting the development of his daughter, or any smart kid for that matter, to the likes of Doris Rodrigue.
"Want to know what your real problem is?" said Charlene, who had passed their booth several times during their conversation and apparently overheard enough to feel qualified to contribute. Charlene hadn't been a small-town waitress all her life for nothing. She entered into the conversations of diners with both confidence and a sense of entitlement. Last spring, David and Miles had each suggested this might not be a good idea with their new evening clientele, especially with the professors, who probably weren't accustomed to having their thinking clarified by waitresses, nor were they likely to tip anyone who'd belittled their logic. Charlene had briefly considered the wisdom of this advice, but in the end rejected it. For one thing, she said, having listened to their conversations, many of the professors badly needed a little clarification. For another, she was confident that despite their carefully trimmed beards, their pressed chinos and tweed jackets, college professors tipped in the same fashion as other men, according to cup size. She was doing very well by them, thanks all the same.
"Your real problem," she told Tick, "is that you're dreaming instead of eating. Shall we let your father in on your secret?"
"The thing is," Tick began, pointing the tines of her fork at Charlene, who surprised both father and daughter by snatching the fork and pointing it back at Tick, who leaned away in mock fear. "And don't give me the thing is."
"What secret?" Miles said.
Charlene handed the fork back to Tick, then put her hands on her hips and regarded him as you would a favored pet, perhaps a dog that's found a place in your heart, even though you've owned other, smarter dogs. "The purpose of this whole conversation has been to distract you from the obvious fact that Tick isn't eating her dinner. Again." In addition to feeling free to enter into the conversations of her customers, Charlene, a full-service waitress, never shirked from reminding people that there was no excuse for wasting good food when other people were going hungry. She was particularly vigilant with Tick, who after her checkup last spring was declared underweight.
Not that Tick was the only one whose eating habits drew Charlene's notice and comment. She'd been on Miles's case for years, pointing out his tendency to pick listlessly at things instead of sitting down to a proper meal. Over the years, he'd fallen into the classic restaurateur's trap of eating his mistakes, the extra order of fries, the under- or overcooked burger, and not just when he was hungry, but whenever they occurred. Tonight, for instance, that bowl of David's bisque, simply because it finished off the pot. It was Charlene's opinion that if Miles could bring himself to toss out every stray French fry that fell onto the counter, he'd weigh no more than his brother David, who was gaunt and sinewy. "It's not nice to tell a person's secrets, Charlene," Tick frowned. "I don't go around telling your secrets." "That shows you're smart," Charlene said. "She hasn't done that bad a job," Miles said weakly, indicating Tick's plate. True, she'd flattened out her food, artfully carving out an area in the middle to suggest that where there had once been food, now there was none. Still, Miles guessed that at least a third of the portion David had served her was gone. "No, Miles," Charlene said. "You're the one who hasn't done such a bad job. You ate your own bisque, and for the last 15 minutes you've been picking at Tick's dinner. Don't tell me you haven't either, because I've been watching you." Well, it was true Miles had been picking at his daughter's food a little, surprised as always by how tasty David's specials were. "I can't help it if I'm not hungry, Charlene," Tick said, pushing her plate away now that there was no point in continuing the charade. "It's not a person's fault if they're not hungry." Charlene pushed the plate back in front of her. "Yes, it is," she said. "That's exactly whose fault it is. Kate Moss is yesterday's news, kid. Eat." When she was gone, Tick speared a small hoisin-covered scallop and bit it in half, surrendering a half-guilty grin to her father. "Charlene has secrets?" Miles said hopefully. It pleased him that she'd been watching him, hinting as it did at the possibility, admittedly remote, of an affection that transcended their long friendship. She'd been between boyfriends for some time, and Miles' divorce would soon be final. So maybe. And for years she'd been claiming that Miles was exactly the sort of man she'd fall in love with if she had any sense at all. A good man, straight and true, who with the slightest encouragement would love her all the days of his life. So again, maybe. Unfortunately, Charlene had also admitted, even after four failed marriages, her abiding preference for bad men, whose insides were all twisted up in knots, and who cleared out the minute the going got tough. They had fast cars and drove them recklessly, and this was something she actually liked about them. There was no telling what would happen if she ever hooked up with a man like Miles, but she suspected she'd end up being mean to him, probably even meaner than Janine had been, which was going some. "I just don't think I could go through life at your speed, Miles," she told him once. "Don't you ever want to just put the pedal down to the floor and just see what it feels like?" Therefore, probably not. "Everybody has secrets except you, Daddy," Tick was saying. Miles considered